This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In so many ways, this election year has been like none other, including the number of instances in which candidates have stretched the truth. Later in the program, we hear from a reporter from PolitiFact about the character of key campaigns in North Carolina. But first, we address the integrity of the vote. Donald Trump has said many times that he believes this election is rigged and has urged his supporters to keep an eye peeled on what happens at polling places around the country. There's also been concern about interference with the election from outside sources that might somehow hack into either our voting machines or the computers that tabulate the votes. So, with that in mind, and because he has nothing else to do, we invited Michael Dickerson to join us. Michael Dickerson is director of the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections. Welcome back.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Are you busy as a one-armed paper hanger?
Yes, and all of that.
Michael's in our Spirit Square studio, and joining us by phone is Lawrence Norden, Deputy Director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. Thank you for joining us this morning as well.
Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do it at Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. So, Michael, how many people have taken advantage so far of early voting in Mecklenburg County?
Currently, as of last night, about 167,000 people have appeared at an early voting site and have voted.
Is that a big turnout for a presidential election?
Well, we're running ahead of 4 years ago, and really far ahead of 8 years ago. We're about 8,000 voters more than what we had 4 years ago.
How do you explain that?
Excitement.
Really? People are excited about this?
Sure. You ought to see. Go out in line.
I thought they were disgusted about it.
No. It's a presidential. Everybody gets excited about a presidential.
Are we? How's the rest of the state in terms of early voting compared to Mecklenburg County?
I think we're usually the highest. Myself and Wake County are usually the highest, and it's been an interesting journey to get to the 167,000 that we've had with the 2.5 weeks versus just 10 days of early voting, the 17 days that we are now required to do, and the 10 sites that it was kind of confusing, but once we opened all the sites last Thursday, everybody caught on, and we've taken off.
I voted Friday. It took me 25 minutes at 11 o'clock in the morning at the main library down the street here. Is that about the right time in terms of wait times everywhere in the county so far?
It depends on where you go. I've got some sites that are really large sites that can handle about 25 voting panels. Mm-hmm. Those folks there, I got an email from one gentleman who said he went to vote. The parking lot was packed at the Morrison Library, which is closed for library patrons but open for us. He said, I'm thinking, oh, this is going to take forever. He said, I put on my watch because I'm a runner. I put the stopwatch on. He said, and 20 minutes later.
Yeah.
Done. After the line, I was walking out, turned my stopwatch off. I said, thank you very much.
So early voting ends on the 5th, which I think is Saturday.
Saturday at 1 o'clock.
And then Election Day is Tuesday. So what kind of a turnout do you anticipate for Election Day itself? What kind of wait time might people find on Election Day itself?
Well, at the rate we're going, we're looking at 280,000 folks voting early. That's probably going to be close to 60% of what turns out. So you're only going to have a 40% turnout of expected turnout on Election Day itself. So usually you see on something like that, big crowds in the morning, maybe a lunchtime rush, and then the drive-home crowd for everybody who put it off until then, but usually not terribly long.
So this time around in North Carolina, we are not using voter ID. You
correct.
Do not have to show a driver's license or any kind of photo ID to vote. So I voted on Friday. What's to prevent me from going on Tuesday in my precinct where I did not vote this time around and voting again? What safeguards are in effect?
Well, first off, keep in mind it would be a violation of the law.
Sure.
So I'd hate to see you doing this program from a jail cell.
Could I sleep in?
Excuse me. The secondly is we record everybody that has voted. We know it was you. So when you go to vote.
How do you know?
How do I know it was you?
They asked me for my name. They asked me for my address. I could have made it up.
And that's true. But here again, we could be also doing this from a jail cell. You don't want to do that. The fear of that is usually good enough for me. I have checked you out before you've gone to vote with your name and your address and your NCDL or your Social Security number, so I know it's you if you indeed pull in and show up. On election day, when you come to show up, your name's going to be listed somewhere different because you've already voted early.
Won't be in the book.
Not going to be. Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
The NCAA reported the NAACP reported mechanical problems with voting machines popping up in the county, and at least four other polling places across the state. And you pulled a couple of machines, if I'm not mistaken, out of an early voting site in Cornelius. What kinds of problems? I'm going to ask the question, what kind of problems have we experienced? But before I ask that question, one of the things we talked about just before we went on the air was that the media focuses on the problems, and by and large, there are none. So what kind of problems did those machines face that caused you to pull them?
Well, and I don't even know if it was those machines.
Okay.
What we do is take every concern very seriously. We don't want folks to think that we are throwing an election or we don't care about their vote. We take every vote very seriously in Mecklenburg County. And what the accusation was that, and it was usually second or third hand, that, I pressed Trump or Clinton and Trump lit up.
Mm-hmm.
A calibration issue on a touchscreen panel, which usually we can take care of recalibrating or something of that nature. And if it keeps going on and doing that again, we'll then pull that machine out of service and just take it out of service. And that's what happened in these two instances.
So if you're behind the screen and you're witnessing problems on the screen, you should call a poll worker.
Exactly. Over. Raise your hand. Say, hey, I've got a problem with this panel. Can you help me out? Tell me what's going on. And they are trained there. We've got technicians standing there that can take care of that issue for you.
Lawrence Norton is with us. He's the deputy director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. And you spoke to NPR, Lawrence, about the allegations of rigging voting machines and said that the real problem isn't the deliberate tampering with voting machines, but the age of the machines themselves. You say they're starting to wear out. Should that inspire me with confidence?
Well, I do think that, you know, we're going to have to replace a lot of machines before not this presidential election, but the next one. They are kind of approaching end of projected lifespan. That happens. You know, these are whether you're voting on a paper ballot and it's read by a scanner or you're voting on a touchscreen, they're computers. And after especially the versions that we have that we're using for voting machines, after 10 or 15 years, it's time to replace them, just as you would replace your laptop or your desktop.
But I use my laptop and my desktop almost every day for hours a day. These things are used for maybe a week and then put into storage for 2 years and then brought back out and used another week. Why would they wear out?
Well, it's not always just a case of wearing out, but in some cases, you know, there is hardware that wears out. I think more often the issue is replacement parts become difficult to find. Think about how much technology has changed in the last 10 or 15 years. We didn't have iPhones or iPads 10 years ago, or even 7 or 8 years ago. The storage devices that we used for memory storage were different. And so when things do break down, as they inevitably do, it becomes very difficult often for election officials to find replacement parts. Software has changed too, and often the software that we're using on these machines isn't supported by vendors anymore. So it just becomes a challenge to keep these machines running and running with the other equipment that they need to run with. I don't think that's an issue for this election. But I do think over the next few years, we have to think seriously, you know, just as for any kind of IT infrastructure that we use, we replace after 10 or 15 years. We should be doing the same thing with voting machines.
Lawrence mentioned outdated software, and some of these voting machines around the country are running the operating system that they're running on is Windows 2000 or Windows XP, both of which are no longer supported by Microsoft because they've moved on several operating systems later. What do our machines work on?
Well, you're talking about something like this, like an XP. You're exactly right. But and Lawrence is exactly correct, too. The stuff I program, the computers I program this equipment with, mm-hmm. It's an old 286 or 386 computer. Honestly.
There are people alive today who don't know what you're talking about.
So I don't have to worry about the hacking piece there. I know. But he's exactly right. These are spreading out. North Carolina has passed a law that said, I think it's by September of 2019, we will need to have replacement equipment. The problem is I want to make sure that we have a voting system standard that the Elections Assistance Commission and the state board here in North Carolina has adopted that brings the software up to at least the a more current version of operating software. The standard now is like 2005, and as Lawrence had said, 10 years, that's a lifetime.
Does that make them less hackable because it's older operating systems and it's older hardware, like a 286 or a 386?
I don't know if it's less hackable, but the fact is that I don't have it connected to the Internet anyway. Right. So that would make it impossible. They don't have wireless cards or anything like that.
You said, Larry, that these aging systems, it's like leaving the front door unlocked every day. Eventually something bad may happen. Do you mean someone tampering with the machine or simply that the machine fails to record votes accurately?
Well, I think that quote was about the fact that we, of course, have to pay attention to security when it comes to voting machines. I didn't mean to suggest that we're leaving our voting machines unlocked every day. What I said was that doesn't mean that there's somebody out there that's going to be trying to hack our machines tomorrow. Nevertheless, we should be taking all security measures that are necessary. When I leave my apartment, I lock my door. It's not because I believe that if I don't, somebody's going to break in immediately, but it's something that I do. And for the same reason, it's the same reason that election officials take voting system security very seriously. It's not that they think there's somebody out there that's getting ready to switch all the votes. But of course, they take voting system security and election integrity very seriously, and we need to make sure that we lock all the doors. That was really my point.
42 or 43 states, I'm not sure how many, use these electronic touchscreen voting machines or some kind of an electronic machine that involves a computer. And some, unlike those in Mecklenburg County, do not leave a paper trail. We have a little paper ticker that runs every time you punch a button on these machines here. How concerned are election officials, party officials, candidates, voters, people at the Brennan Center for Justice concerned about these machines that do not leave a paper trail?
Well, what I would say about that is there's even with having a paper trail or a paper ballot is a redundancy. It's an extra it's something extra that you can look at to double check the accuracy that the totals that the machine are giving you. There's lots that you can do, even if there is not a paper trail, to make sure that the machines are working accurately. There's all kind of testing that's done beforehand, and we do reconciliation afterwards. Having said that, I think particularly in this environment where there's unfortunately more and more talk of rigged elections, where I think social media can help create an even more fraught environment. I am concerned about having systems without paperware. There's already been a lot done to kind of undermine voter confidence, and that if you have a very close election, that people may use that to further attempt to undermine confidence in the results. So my preference personally would be to have that extra record to show people as evidence that they can trust election totals.
And we do have that, and we'll talk about that a little bit when we come back. And then I want to talk about this whole charge that this election could be rigged and whether or not it actually could be rigged. Can you rig an American election? We'll talk about that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Novant Health Cancer Care, providing customized treatment plans and a team of professionals to help give patients the support they need. Information available at novanthealth.org/cancer. And Blumenthal Performing Arts presenting Mannheim Steamroller Christmas by Chip Davis, blending classical music with new age and rock. to perform Christmas favorites November 25th at Belk Theater. Tickets at 704-372-1000. Most of North Carolina's textile and furniture manufacturing jobs have long disappeared, but there seems to be a flicker of hope in the furniture industry. Upholstery is on the rebound. It requires highly skilled workers because of the custom nature of the work. And in fact, there's a training academy for upholstery workers with a waiting list to get in. We talk about what this means for the state and for workers tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, FBI Director James Comey is facing widespread criticism for announcing an investigation into more of Hillary Clinton's emails just days before the presidential election. The latest on the investigation and the political firestorm it's created.
Join the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the election and going to the polling places right now, what to expect, how long the wait is, and can you rig an American election? With Michael Dickerson, director of the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections, and Lawrence Norden, deputy director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. Our voting machines, Michael, do leave a paper trail. When you select something on the touch screen, there's a little piece of paper down there on the lower left-hand corner of the machine that looks like the grocery store tape that prints out the name of the person you just voted for. Mm-hmm. Most people, I would imagine, do not check every time the thing prints.
Correct.
I did because I'm aware of this. And it printed out precisely what I put on the touchscreen. Are you anticipating that most people do that to check that the accuracy of their paper tape vote is being recorded correctly?
It's funny you said that. I have complete confidence in the system. I went to vote early up at the Hal Marshall Sunday week ago or something, and I didn't even look at it. I didn't even care about it because I have programmed these and seen that they do work.
But to be clear, the paper tape is a backup. When it comes time to tally the votes, you're not looking at the paper tape. You're looking at what's coming out of the bits and bytes of the machine.
Exactly. Well, again,
so how do we know that? How do we know that? Okay, I select candidate A. I see it on my screen. I look down on the paper tape. There's candidate A's name. But maybe in the guts of the machine, it's voted for candidate B. How do I know that?
Right. One thing, the most important thing is that I have tested all this equipment so that I know with a script test vote, I know that if I'm pressing three votes for this person, two votes for this person, one vote for this person, I know I'm going to get that script test vote result. So I feel good about it. Secondly, North Carolina requires, after the election, the state board will randomly select, I think it's 2% of the precincts, and tell me to hand count those results by that paper audit trail that you just talked about.
And then
about.
They'll count the results.
I will do it, exactly. I will count that, match it up against the computer results.
Why don't they bring in an outside party to do the counting? Why you?
Why me? Because probably our staff is qualified to do that.
Yes, but wouldn't your staff be more prone to make sure that the vote on the paper tape duplicates the vote you reported?
Well, not when I don't know what the results are going to be, which precincts they want me to count. Okay. The random is there.
But this is the last election that we'll be using these voting machines in, correct?
Well, last presidential. Technically, we're required to get rid of these by September of 2019.
And replace them with?
Yeah, currently, the only thing they've got out there is a fill-in-the-bubble.
We'll be using pen and paper to do this and scanning it in.
Yeah.
Why is that any better?
That's what I'm asking. This is a banking city down here. We love to have our ATM machines.
Right.
Why can't I keep doing something like that?
Lawrence, how do you feel about the difference between the touchscreen voting machines that we're using here in Mecklenburg County and around the country and this business of taking an SAT test with a number two lead pencil and then scanning it in? Can't the scanner also be corrupt? Oh, I'm sorry. I had you off. Start over again with your answer. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Lawrence.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can now.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I said, sure. A scanner is a computer just the same as the touchscreen machine that you're voting on. Of course, with the optical scan machine with the pen and paper, you, the voter, are filling it out. So you have less of an issue in terms of if you're worried about that, whether or not it's been checked. If you filled it out, obviously you checked it to begin with. I do think we're actually probably moving to a convergence of these two systems. I think the future is probably going to be something where you have a and they're developing the system in Los Angeles where you you vote on a touchscreen and it prints out your ballot for you, and then that is scanned. So there's an opportunity for you to it goes into your hands, you review it, and then you put it into a scanner. So that's probably at the end of the day what we're all going to be voting on, although that might take another 10 or 15 years.
Okay. Let's talk about election rigging. Donald Trump has been alleging that this election is rigged. That statement has been said less frequently since Friday, but nonetheless, he's made that allegation. In your opinions, is it even remotely possible to rig a presidential nationwide election in a country with tens of thousands of precincts? Is it possible to do it?
From my perspective, I couldn't see how it could be done. Considering that each state runs its own election process, you're talking 50 states, heads of states that are in the elections business, getting together and say, we're going to do this. And then they're going to eventually work itself down to my office of 2,500 people out there working on election day saying, and this is how we're going to rig that. Somewhere along the line, somebody would say something. I can't imagine. But with that being said, we are constantly vigilant in our process.
And in this state, Lawrence, proponents of voter ID promoted the legislation as a way to combat voter fraud. The same was true in other states where they were promoting the use of voter ID. How widespread is voter fraud in the United States?
It is vanishingly small for – I can't remember if this – Michael was discussing this before we got on or afterwards, but – it is for good reason. It's a crime to do something like that, and it would be a very stupid crime. You are going into a polling place and pretending to be somebody else. Very easy to get caught. You're leaving a record behind. There have been many, many investigations into whether or not this happens. It should be fairly easy to find out if it does, because somebody's leaving behind evidence that they've voted under a dead person's name or under another person's name. And what we found is a person is more likely to get struck by lightning than to commit voter fraud.
And in fact, the Brennan Center did a report on voter fraud. It said that most reported incidents are actually traceable to other sources, like clerical errors or bad data matching practices. How widespread are those things?
That can easily happen. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Even that is fairly rare. But 99 times out of 100, at least, when you read about something like that, it is because of clerical error or some other misreporting. And it's not just the Brennan Center that says this, I should say. There have been several independent studies that have gone back over the years and looked. And in the modern era, I should say, where we have professionalized elections and much more transparent system, as I said, it is vanishingly small. And the courts have found this, and as I said, many, many independent studies as well.
Donald Trump also has encouraged followers to, quote, stop the steal by monitoring polling places for possible fraudulent activity and to poll departing voters. Have you witnessed any of that going on in Mecklenburg County?
Nothing yet, but we're, like you said, being vigilant with that.
So what rules would apply? If I was a Donald Trump supporter and I want to follow my candidate's suggestion and make sure nothing weird is going on at my polling place, what am I allowed to do?
First off, if you're going to be inside a polling place here in Mecklenburg County and in North Carolina, you must be credentialed. Basically, the party committee has to say, these are the people we permit to go into this.
So I can't stand around the line?
No, you cannot go in. You can, outside that 50-foot buffer zone, you can stand and watch and observe. You can't obstruct. because our job is to keep the place open and unobstructed so that people can come in freely and vote.
And so I can't go in, vote, and hang around
the
room and watch.
No. It's against North Carolina. You need to vote and get out.
Can I talk to people after they've left the voting booth to see how they voted?
Outside the 50-foot line? Sure. Sure. If you were so far, we have a 50-foot buffer around every voting enclosure. So the 50-foot entrance from this door, front door here, you could do that.
This is the first election in 50 years that is underway without the full protection of the Voting Rights Act. Mm-hmm. A 2013 Supreme Court ruling invalidated a key section of that law under which trained monitors oversee access to ballot boxes in areas historically prone to discrimination. Mm-hmm. Rather than Trump supporters being afraid of rigging, should voters in those areas be worried?
I wouldn't in North Carolina. I think we do a great job here. I think we have all the checks and processes in place. Our executive director at State Board has pushed that down through to the ranks of us at the county boards.
There's also fear that if amateur poll watchers come out to watch the polls for shenanigans and question people exiting the polling places, that there will be illegal voter intimidation, discrimination, disruption at the polls. What safeguards, if any, do you have in place for that?
Well, we've got a couple of things. Obviously, we police the area ourselves to make sure that that doesn't happen. And if somebody is obstructing the polling place or the voting location, our solution is 911, and we will get police there to take care of this problem. Usually you can talk to somebody and they can take care of it.
Have there been any problems reported around the country, Lawrence?
I haven't seen anything major. I will say I think North Carolina rules is a good one. Obviously, this varies state by state. But, you know, where in the past where there have been efforts at organizing poll watchers in certain places, inevitably you do have problems of intimidation and obstruction. And obviously the most important thing is to make sure that that elections are free and fair and that you don't have the polling place can be a complicated place to run. You don't have interference with that running. I think the good news, if there is any, in all this talk about having poll watchers and watching out for things, is that election officials around the country are really aware that this is a potential issue and have steps in place to be ready if there is a problem.
We've gone over this on past programs about this, but there have been reports of hacking of political parties, particularly their email systems, and hacking of voting machines, not machines, but the voter registration computers
at
a polling boards of election around the country. Are you worried that any foreign entity, anybody, any hacker anywhere, could get into not the voting machines, because you say they do not ever touch the internet,
correct?
But the machines that tally the votes or the little blocks that the poll associates put in the machine to put your precinct information into the machine so you get the right ballot. None of that ever touches the internet.
Correct.
Does it ever touch a thumb drive? Does it ever touch a floppy disk? Are there floppy disks anymore? Does it ever touch a CD that could be inserted into the computer? Does it ever, could it be corrupted when you insert the ballot instructions into the machine?
Right. On our end, for most part, no. That never. We program using the equipment that the vendor has sold us 10 years ago, 2006, when we first started buying these. So we've been using this for quite some time. We program with that equipment, and we make sure that everything is running there. We do not put anything on the internet until the very end. And we tally the votes with the same non-connected-to-the-internet computer that we use to program the equipment. So we tally the votes using that same non-internet-connected computer. And only then do we print a report, download the results to a thumb drive, and literally take the thumb drive out and walk it over to a computer that is attached to the internet.
But if that computer that's attached to the internet is infected in some way, when you put that thumb drive in, and if you ever use that thumb drive again to go back to that other computer, aren't you opening it up to possible infection.
Well, the good thing is we don't use that thumb drive again. We keep a record of everything we do that way. And we're also printing out a report. We're printing out a report that says this is who you paper report that says these are the votes that you had for
is
this.
Is it done like this in most places in the country?
Oh, I know it definitely in North Carolina it is.
All right. If I'm not mistaken, Larry, you believe that worrying about the integrity of elections in the context of cybercrime instead of technological problems actually undermines the problem. So are you saying that machine failure is much more likely and more concerning than hacking of the voting system?
I think always accidents and human error and failures are more likely to happen than hacking. And the good news on hacking is everything that Michael said should be done, and we've got lots of redundancies in place if somehow something happens. And actually, frankly, that's how we generally catch mistakes. We have so many redundancies built in the system, so many records that are printed out. We have a number of people who have signed in. We can check these things. I do think, though, as you said, as equipment ages, with social media kind of broadcasting issues, it's easy to undermine confidence in the context of lots of media attention and candidates talking about rigged elections, hearing about hacking. I think it's very easy to kind of spread those rumors. So that is a concern for sure.
Let me share some emails that have come in very quickly while we're talking because we're very short on time. Dennis says, I've seen stories about the legality of taking selfies in polling places. What's the deal here?
You cannot.
You cannot. Why
not? Take a
Why
selfie?
Not?
Well, it's basically you're taking a picture of your ballot and you're posting that. That's not permitted behind, and I cannot use photography inside my voting booth.
Suzanne writes, other than absentee voting, how can a college student vote when they are in school outside of the county where they are registered to vote and they are not able to return to that county to vote?
Well, if they consider the county of origin their residence, then they need to vote there, and they would have to do an absentee by mail, and if they're going to do it, download that form now, because today at 5 o'clock is the deadline to ask for an absentee ballot by mail.
Okay. And Kelsey says, I have complete faith in the voting system in this country.
Thank you, Kelsey.
The voting stations are not connected to the Internet, and the vast majority of election workers are working in good faith for the American election system. Conversations like these fuel the ridiculous concept that the system is rigged and encourage voters to not turn out and lose faith in our system. I would take issue with that, Kelsey. I think conversations like these put a pin in the balloon created by certain candidates that are spreading like wildfire through this country. Speaking of which, Donald Trump told Sean Hannity that you have 1.8 million people who are dead, who are registered. This is a quote. 1.8 million people who are dead, who are registered to vote, and some of them absolutely vote. Can that happen? Does that happen? Could it happen here?
Here in Mecklenburg County? Sure. Can I have dead people on the rolls? It's going to happen. There's a process for removing voters from the rolls. It's a list maintenance process. I can't willy-nilly go out and just start taking names off the rolls. You don't want me to do that. You want to protect everybody and assume that everybody is accurate. But I do a list maintenance process that is prescribed by the state and the general statutes that allows me to eventually get everybody off the rolls.
But could a dead person could a person come as a dead person and vote?
That can happen. That's why we are always, tell our folks to be vigilant.
How would you know?
Yeah.
Good question.
And I should say again, this is
very quickly.
Donald Trump's representation or not, this would be something, if it was happening on a wide scale, would be very easy to find out.
Lawrence Norton with the NYU School of Law and Michael Dickerson with our Board of Elections here in Meck County. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nexen Pruitt, over 190 lawyers helping companies meet business challenges in court and at the deal table from Charlotte and seven other Carolina locations. Next challenge, next level, Nexen Pruitt. And Goodwill Industries of the Southern Piedmont, dedicated to changing lives through the power of work and creating family-sustaining employment at the Goodwill Opportunity Campus. Information at goodwillsp.com. FBIDirector.org. FBI Director James Comey is facing widespread criticism for announcing an investigation into more of Hillary Clinton's emails just days before the presidential election. So, on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes, the latest on the investigation and the political firestorm it has created. That's coming up at 10. And coming up on this program, moments from now, we're going to talk about fact-checking. We're going to fact-check some of our candidates in North Carolina with PolitiFact. Stay with us.
Republicans, Democrats, independents, beer lovers, and news junkies, join WFAE for an election night results watching party at Free Range Brewing on North Davidson Street. The party starts at 7 p.m. on Election Day, November 8th. We'll listen to and watch coverage from WFAE's news department, NPR, and PBS as the polls close. Information at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. One of the unfortunate characteristics of this election cycle has been the manner in which facts have been treated. To say they have been treated loosely would be an understatement. In fact, in many cases, facts have been ignored, replaced by a repetition of bald-faced lies. And there are some voters who simply don't care. They don't want their preconceived notions to be blurred by facts. All of this has provided plenty of grist for fact-checkers, not just on the national level, but in races here in North Carolina. So for those who still care about the accuracy of what candidates are alleging in various key races here in the state, we've invited Will Doran to be with us. He is a reporter for PolitiFact North Carolina at the Raleigh News and Observer, and he joins us now by phone. Will, thank you for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be on.
We've all heard that, at least at the national level, the presidential candidates have played loose with the truth. Donald Trump, according to PolitiFact and other fact-checkers, more so than Clinton, at least with statements that they've made. How do key North Carolina candidates, those running for governor and in the Senate race, stack up?
Well, you know, they obviously aren't as high-profile as Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and you know, obviously, it's a smaller operation here in North Carolina than it is nationally. So I'd caution putting too much stock in comparing their side by side ratings. But really, what you see here is honestly, both sides care a little bit more about the facts on the national level. I don't know if that means that they feel that they're a little bit more beholden to the voters or what. But you get fewer pants on fires. You know, here on the state level, it's a lot of half-truths, mostly true, mostly falses, you know, things that are a little bit true but kind of tweaked to maybe be a bit misleading.
So we've all heard of PolitiFact, and we've all seen your ratings on various statements by various candidates, I would think, at this point in the game. But what is PolitiFact? Who are you guys, and how do you do what you do?
Sure. Well, PolitiFact started back in 2008. After that election, and it has a single goal, which is to look at statements and claims that politicians make and put it on our truthometer, which is basically our little needle ranking system that has six different rankings from true, mostly true, half true, mostly false, false, pants on fire. And obviously, as you go down the ranking, it gets the claims get more and more and more dubious.
But how do you determine that something is mostly true or mostly false or pants on fire? How do you make that determination?
Sure. Well, a big part of it is looking at the original document. Someone will make a claim about, someone's vote. So we'll go and we'll read that bill and, try and cut through some of the partisan spin on it and just see what the actual words in it say. Or, a lot of times this is very complicated stuff that we look at, tax policy, foreign issues, things like that. So we'll call up noted experts in their fields. We're always very careful about noting, if these people work for a think tank that has a certain partisan bent. We try to go nonpartisan as much as possible. We rely on experts a lot to kind of inform us, and often we'll try and get multiple points of view and see if people are in agreement or not.
But a lot of these things are very intricate. So sometimes a candidate will say something about another candidate that is partially accurate because you don't have all the facts. And when you look at some of the facts, it maybe even clouds the picture even more. And then you have to add in the fact that everybody in some way is biased or somewhat partisan. How do you take all of that out of the equation? How do you know you're taking all of that judgment out of the equation?
Sure. And sometimes that is impossible to do. And so sometimes we'll start writing something and then we'll get to the end and determine, hey, you know what, it's just, it's impossible. It's not fair for us to put a rating on this. So sometimes we'll just write an article without the ruling. That doesn't happen too often.
Right.
But we have run into that before. And out of fairness, we'll try and do that. But whenever we can make a rating, we definitely try to do it. We have actually a group of people that get together, who have all been steeped in the PolitiFact, training and ideals and everything like that. And, we all talk about it and vote on what we think the ruling should be.
So let's look at the North Carolina governor's race. On your PolitiFact scorecard for Pat McCrory, you have said that 8% of what he has said is true. 25% is half true, 42% is mostly false, and 17% is outright false, with 8% you've put in the pants on fire category, which is that old liar, pants on fire category, which means, I guess, what, it's an abject, absolute, bald-faced lie?
Yes, that's something that is, false, plus with an element of kind of ridiculousness.
So let's take the truth.
It's not just false.
Let's take the truth first. What is Pat McCrory telling the truth about?
He has been telling truth, and this is something that's come up a lot on the campaign, about North Carolina's economy bouncing back post-recession here. Probably one of the first claims we looked into from him, and I forget the exact wording right now, but was that essentially North Carolina had the fastest growing economy in the country. And we looked at that, and in terms of GDP, which is the state's economic output, that is true.
The actual quote is, North Carolina has one of the fastest growing populations as well as the fastest growing economy in the country. And you say that is true. The Carolina comeback is true.
Yeah. Well, obviously when you get into the Carolina comeback language, that includes a lot of things, wages, things like that. And as we note in the story, not everything is the fastest growing or even
I'm going to push you through this, Will, because we're really short on time. I'm going to push you like a demon through this. Pat McCrory begins to slip into the half-truth area when he's starting to talk about HB2. He says that despite the passage of HB2, towns, cities, and counties in North Carolina are still allowed to set stricter non-discrimination policies for their own employees if they choose. That's not true?
That was one of the cases where it was, you just don't know. So here you have him making this claim, about what cities are going to be allowed to do. But then I talked to some people with the cities who were affected, and they were saying, well, wait a second, we don't think that's necessarily the case. Hmm. So there was a lot of confusion and disagreement on that one.
And he also says that HB2 will not threaten funding for public schools under Title IX, but you call that half-truth. So what is the truth?
That is there was a judge several months ago in Virginia who ruled in favor of what McCrory had said there. But at the same time, you also had several school districts in other states that had conformed with what the federal government wanted out of fear of losing their Title IX funding, and clearly saw it as a very real threat. So that was a case where he had one instance that backed him up, but several other instances that did not. Mm-hmm. which is why that only received a half true.
And as far as making false statements, you cite the governor saying, we have not taken away any rights that have currently existed in any city in North Carolina with the passage of HB 2. So again, what is the truth?
Well, that one was just false. Several cities required their contractors to have, you know, LGBT protections, which HB 2 took away their right to do that. HB 2 also originally took away the right of people to file employment discrimination lawsuits in state courts. Now, that has since been restored to the law, but the law did originally take that right away.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and at the time that he made that claim, those rights had not yet been restored.
Okay. When it comes to the pants on fire category from McCrory, there was really only one that I could follow, only one comment that he said that you say pants on fire in the aftermath of HB 2. Bruce Springsteen, he said, only had 8,000 tickets sold for a concert he canceled in Greensboro and that he canceled after he didn't get the ticket sales he wanted. He has since apologized for that remark because he called it a mistake. So does a comment like that really matter?
Well, I think it shows, and especially back really at the height of the discussion over HB 2, it showed kind of the the reaction to try and maybe shrug blame or put the blame on other people. And as we found, he's saying that Springsteen canceled the show for ticket sales. No, the show was sold out, or basically sold out. He canceled it in opposition to HB 2. That one actually got picked up by a couple members of the E Street Band on Twitter, I remember. They were, a bit unhappy with the way that they were being portrayed as well. And in the governor's defense, he did, acknowledge that he was wrong and, apologize for the statement. So,
So let's switch our focus to his challenger, Roy Cooper, the attorney general, the Democrat. You say that the majority of what Roy Cooper has said is true. Before we talk about the truths and the half-truths and the mostly false comments of Roy Cooper, though, how do you pick and choose what comments to fact-check on anybody, for that matter?
That's an excellent question. There's obviously a lot that I can't get to, and so what we try and pick, and honestly, a lot of the times it's just a judgment call for me or for my editors. It'll be things that are, frequently playing in ads on television, for example, claims that a lot of people are going to be seeing, or, claims from, one of their debates that, might have gotten a lot of attention, or just, policy issues that we think are important for people to understand.
So going back to the governor, you said that 8% of what he said is true, 25% half true, 42% mostly false, 17% outright false, and 8% pants on fire. The Roy Cooper, you say, is 20% mostly true, 60%, 60% half true, and 20% mostly false. Where does he stumble?
He, as you can see there, his most frequent category is the half true, and that's usually when something is, maybe technically correct, but leaves out a lot of context or nuance, or maybe gives a slightly different impression. So something that's not outright false, but
so when he says McCrory took $500,000 directly out of the disaster relief fund for HB 2, you've called that half true. The governor in 67 different ways has raised taxes on middle income families. You've called that half true. How so? Why so?
Right. Well, and as you can see, those are things that, sound good as, little talking points, snippets, 15 second sound bites. But, the reality is that it's a lot more complicated than that. Taking for instance the claim about taxes, that McCrory had raised taxes on the middle class in 67 different ways. There were 67, I think it was actually more, I think it was 68 or 69 different ways in which McCrory had passed bills from the General Assembly that raised taxes or cut tax deductions, things like that. But the claim ignores obviously that McCrory and the General Assembly also cut income taxes, which certainly helped the middle class as well as the wealthy, and kind of leaves out that a lot of these tax increases don't really affect people like on boat repairs or fire extinguisher recharging. I don't think, you know, you or I have that done very often.
Given the fact that this is a battleground state and the Democrats are hoping to retake the Senate, you would think that there would be a lot more noise coming from the Senate race here. And there really hasn't been all that much noise. Maybe life is different in Raleigh, but down here it's been pretty quiet. You've categorized as half-truths these Deborah Ross statements. Senator Burr voted no on the Violence Against Women Act. The senator took millions from special interests, went to Washington and cashed in, voted to cut his own taxes and raise taxes on working folks. So those are half-truths that Deborah Ross has made about Richard Burr. What is the truth in those cases?
Sure. Well, I'll start with the Violence Against Women Act. Burr did vote against it once in 2012, so it's one of those that it's technically right, but she leaves out the fact that he also voted for it three other times. So, you know, that's a convenient fact that gets left out of her claim, which is why it only earns a half-true. And then the other one, it's a little bit more of a mouthful, but, you know, essentially that he has taken millions from special interests and voted to cut taxes for millionaires and raise taxes for the working class. We looked at all three parts of that, and Richard Burr is a favorite of business interests and super PACs. When he first ran for the Senate back in 2004, I believe he was the top recipient nationwide of PAC money, and this year he's the number one recipient from, you know, the tobacco industry, and I believe from the pharmaceutical industry as well.
Meanwhile, you've given Richard Burr a half-truth ranking on his statement that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are responsible for leading America into a deal that will arm Iran, and that is the only fact check of Burr that I could find. Is that because you're not following his comments, aren't checking his comments, or because he's told the truth most of the time, or he's not saying anything? What's the deal there?
A lot of the ads coming from his camp. Well, one, there's a lot of outside money in his race, so it's not a lot of things that he is personally saying. You know, a lot of it is things that groups are saying on his behalf. And some of the things that are coming from him are, I guess, you know, a little bit more, you know, opinionated about you know, Deborah Ross and, you know, her, you know, her background normally with ACLU, and we definitely do not check opinions. There's no way to fact check an opinion, so that probably plays into it somewhat.
Will Doran is a reporter for PolitiFact here in North Carolina and also with the Raleigh News and Observer. I would not want your job. You must spend all of your time digging through reams of information. Well, that's what I do, as a matter of fact.
Well, I enjoy it.
Thank you for joining us.